So, that is nice for a change to have the audience calm down at the beginning of the talk. Welcome, everyone. My name is Dr. Michael Petter. I'm your lecturer for this term. And I might also introduce you to your tutor for the tutorial sessions.
I'm Michael, and I'll be responsible for the tutorials. So there are going to be 2 dates. I think you can already vote for them via a Doodle, which is linked on the website. Is it not possible?
No.
Okay.
I'll change it wasn't possible to the 15 minutes ago.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. I'll see what's going on. I'll mostly be discussing the exercise sheets with you and hopefully give you some useful guidance. And I think the tutorial will start next week.
Yes. Yeah. So you will be able to find the first exercise sheet from today on Moodle. This is meant to be solved at home, and then the week after we will have a discussion on that online in the tutorial sessions. And the very first exercise sheet should be one that should be really doable with the knowledge from just introduction to theoretical computer science. So this shouldn't be too much of a problem for you. But anyway, this is a kind of an introductory thing for the whole lecture, as we will start right from this lecture on with these basics. And I think it is a good exercise to repeat them and get oneself in the mood of automata and ugly expressions and all these nice things. So for the sheets after this one, then you will also be able to ask questions when they arise, because you will be able to see the sheet while there's still one tutorial session left before you actually have to hand it in. So there's possibility to ask questions whether they still arise. But I would strongly advise you to try to stay up to date with all the materials that I tell you here, and also to come to me for questions, because it is always a good idea to ask these in front of the whole class, because there might be a lot of you who have not gotten my crazy things that I'm talking about on these slides. So I think the whole audience will have a benefit from you asking the questions immediately.
Sure, so okay, I'll be upstairs then and check what's going on with the Doodle, and then you should be able to vote on the
day. And I think if you want to reach him, there should be possibilities via the Moodle. I think that you should be linked as a tutor.
Yeah, I think I should meanwhile. Otherwise I can try to get my email address.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a doodle meant for you to vote on your favorite date for the tutorial sessions, and then we will choose the two sessions that look most promising in terms of audience, and these will be the new dates. Okay, so as we already reached the page with the organizational stuff, what I should probably warn you, if you are someone who likes to have multiple exams, as all the lectures in our topic, we will have one exam, which happens to be in the summer. There won't be a repeated exam. We will, because we know that this is then only one chance for you to survive the whole thing, we will try to make it not as difficult as in these types of lectures where you have two of these things, but you should take it seriously, because there's only one shot that you have for this thing. So be aware of that. That might be a little bit of a problem. Okay. Apart from that, the date for the final exam is something that that was managed centrally via this TUM online service. So I don't have any control on that. And I also don't have any knowledge about the date until it appears to as well you as also us. So there's no point in asking for the date prematurely. But one thing I should also say, as we are aware that we only offer one written exam date, there might be conflict. So there might be the case that you have another exam overlapping. And even on the same day, we think it was a little bit hard for you to write two exams on the same day. So if this happens to be the case, please don't hesitate and tell. And we will make an arrangement for some kind of replacement date for you in this case. Yeah. Also, the same thing goes, of course, if you are somehow disabled, if you crack your hand or something like that, then please tell us in advance and we try to come up with a solution. In this case, probably also the Studienbüro will kind of manage some kind of special treatment for you. Okay. What you also can get in this lecture is a 0.3 bonus on your final grade. This you can earn via submitting your exercise sheets with a solution, and in case you get 50% of the answers right, then you will earn this bonus. Good. Then the other thing that might be of importance for you is what do we actually need in order to succeed in this lecture? Well, you should be either in your master's or you should have studied in the bachelor's for at least 5 semesters, so that you will have had a lot of lectures already. Of course, a lot of these very basic ones, but especially the lecture on theoretical computer science is the one that is most important. So this will have introduced you already to automata and grammars and regular expressions, all these kinds of things, because we will have the first part of the lecture talking especially about how to create efficient implementations for these types of algorithms. So if you have not heard this kind of lecture and these kind of contents before, then you should either catch up very fast or probably think of doing the whole thing in 1 year. Yeah, the other thing that might be that you might be greatly where you might have a benefit from is foundations of computers in terms of technical stuff. So you should have seen an assembly language at least once in your curriculum, so that the second part of the lecture won't be for nothing, because in the second part we will talk about how to generate target code from the things that you have gathered in your source codes. So if you haven't seen any machine architecture before, then you might have a little bit of trouble there. Yeah, in case you find the topics that we treat here really nice, then you should probably also consider the other events that are happening around these topics. Especially this semester, there's also virtual machines. This is a special purpose lecture that covers most of what we do in the second part, as well as a little bit more. This means that we will talk about how to generate code for programs that are procedural in virtual machines. This is something that we're going to cover here also, but even more in virtual machines, we will have architectures for functional languages, architectures for logical languages. We will have extensions for object-oriented code. And finally, we will talk about how to generate code for threads, mostly. So this will be covered in virtual machines. What is also In parallel is the lab course on compiler construction. This time we will be covering building an development environment for a legacy language. So what we're going to create is an Eclipse plugin for COBOL. So if you like to work on compilers, then this should be the course which fascinates you. Then the other things that might interest you, if you find nice this semester, then you can go next semester into kind of the conceptual part two of this language, which is program optimization. And this is catching up with this lecture at the point where we where we are in between. Is this a message for you? Then I should consider taking it. No? Then please don't do that in future. Yeah. So there will be program optimization. This is the language that connects to the point where we have the intermediate representation of programs, which is sort of in between reading the sources and generating the target. In program optimization, we will talk a lot about semantics of program languages and how to transform languages according to certain principles, like correctness of your programs, but also optimality in terms of speed or space. So this will be the topics of program optimization. Then there's programming languages, which will introduce a few concepts that we will not be able to cover here due to space and time constraints. So there will be things about parallel programming, there will be things about object-oriented programming, about program structuring, and all that. And of course, there's seminars, especially in the winter semester. We have the code generation seminar, which is always quite nice, because we try to do it externally on Frauenchiemsee, where we will have a kind of conference atmosphere together, staying there 2 days and having a blocked session of compiler construction and machine architecture talks. So that might be also interesting for you. So what are the materials that you are going to get to help you in this course? Well, of course, there will be the things that we directly produce in class. This will mean that we will have lecture recordings with the tool that you see me using already. So the whole thing is recorded and stored in the web, and you can download it and replay it to your own likings. I will also put online the slides separately from the recordings, so that you can just print them and mark annotations. Also, you should be able to find last year's lecture, where most of the content is really one-to-one relation to this year's lecture. So there's not many differences. For those of you who like to take notes into the slides, this might be the way to go. Go get those slides and just copy the things that you might need in addition to the things that are already printed out there. Then there's the related literature, especially the compiler construction or compiler design books from Wilhelm Seidel-Hack. And there are multiple volumes, and the one with which we are going to start is the one on the front end, so scanning and parsing. So I think it should be linked from the home page directly. And this book is kind of heavily influenced from the lecture that we give at this chair. So there's a lot of direct correspondences to things that we are talking about here in this lecture to the book. So you can find alternative explanations there. What we're also offering you are several tools that you can use to test the things that you're learning here. So we will have, for the first part of the lecture, we will have tools for generating compilers. Especially there's this JFlex, which is for the very first part. This is for generating scanners. Then we will have CUP, which is for generating parsers. And last but not least, when we come to the point where we can generate code, we will be able to test this code via the tool for visualization of abstract machines. That is this VAM tool. All these should be linked from the homepage, and I'm sure you will be getting links to them in the tutorial sessions. So these are our recommendations for this lecture. What is the contents for our lecture? So we will be talking about, of course, you've heard that there's connections to theoretical computer science, so we'll be talking about regular expressions and automata. We will talk about how these techniques can be implemented in order to get things that we call scanners. We will also be talking about context-free grammars and pushdown automata, both of which you should already have seen in the past. We will use them to implement bottom-up syntax analysis, as well as top-down syntax analysis, but that's a smaller chapter. We will then extend the notion of context-free grammars to attribute systems and attribute grammars, which carry a lot more possibilities for attaching semantics to your structural definitions, declarations, sorry. Then we will use that in order to achieve source code analysis, good for type checking. So that is the point that we, or that is the content that we use for analyzing source code. And then we'll switch over to generating target code. So we will talk about code generation for stack machines. And I think this year I'm not going to do stack machines. That's something that you will learn about in virtual machines, but we're going to treat register machines. Yeah. So register assignment might be something that we are not so interested in, except for that for an infinite set of registers, we still need to come up with a mapping onto machine architectures that only offer a limited set of registers. So that is the only thing that's left for register assignment at that point. No, not like this. That's going to happen in every lecture. So register assignment. And last but not least, we will, depending on how much time we have left, we will talk about basic optimization techniques, at least for the parts of the system that we have already seen. Okay, so is there any question left on organization or on taking part of lecture or any questions? I would like to start like that, but if the majority of people say that it would be better to start at 12:30 or at 2:00 sharply, then I would change. So is there a request? Do you want to start? 2:15, is there any objections? So I think we'll start at 2:15. Everybody fine? Okay. So, well, that's actually quite good. The last years, I think, got the feeling of that about 10 people went from the first lecture, so that's still good. Okay, so let's start with introduction. What is compiler construction all about? So there's, first of all, what was the general problem of compiler construction? For compiler construction, you usually get people who are interested in, at first they have a kind of very high-level defined algorithm in some kind of a source program. That is something that is given to you. And in many cases, people also have concrete input for this type of algorithm. And the role of the compiler or the whole runtime system altogether is from program specification and input generate the output. That is the thing that the users are desiring to have. So, yeah, in general, if you start with that setting and just implement a block that solves this problem, you will end up with something that we call an interpreter. The interpreter is something that goes through the whole problem in one run, and what it will especially not do is any kind of pre-processing. And it will just start from the high level and do all the computations that it finds necessary by need. So that is something that we call an interpreter. So theoretically, there are systems that do something like that. And the characteristics is that they usually don't have any pre-processing, so they can start right from calling time, and so there's not a large startup time, something like that. So there's no need to set up lots of tables and analyze the sources in advance. As you have heard me already mentioning, that you kind of by need start to compute helper structures, you run into the situation quite soon, and there's actually a lot of things that needs to be done in order to execute certain algorithms. And when you do them without preparation, you might need to do a lot of computations that are strictly not necessary if you arrange your program structures, helper structures, in a more efficient way. And all in all, you end up with a longer runtime, at least theoretically. So the next step for people who had to write this kind of software was to say, well, as the most programs are meant to be not only run once, but several times, it might be a good idea to do a lot of these computations that are generally valid in advance, and come up with a software that that creates a kind of pre-computed piece of software, a piece of code, which can then be used to execute the algorithm in a more efficient way. So that is the thinking that is behind the separation of compile time and runtime. So the compile time is there to reduce the runtime work by doing a lot of computations statically in advance. So that is the concept of a compiler. Of course, when you apply this technique, you will have to invest a lot of time beforehand in order to introduce all the, or in order to compute all these efficient structures. But in the end, you hope that it pays off because your program will run either a long time or very often. So that with this optimized piece of code that you provide the system with, the execution can actually be a lot more, can be done more quickly. So these are the two extreme cases that we know for concepts for compiling and executing software. Of course, in modern systems, many of the systems that are out there don't exhibit such a strict separation of these two phases anymore, especially if you think about systems that already come with a virtual machine, like this .NET things or Java. You will see systems that have compilers that don't do so much of analysis beforehand. So the code parts that you get out of such a system is code that is but has a kind of naive scheme. So there are not a lot of optimizations already done on the very first level. The only thing, purpose that this code has is kind of creating a representation of your algorithm with a very clear and compact instruction set that is suitable for translating on many target machines. And a lot of the work is actually then done in the runtime, where originally the machine should just execute everything, but in such systems you have hotspot compilers attached to the runtime engines that will do kind of measurements during the runtime, where where the code gets augmented with kind of counters that do measurements on how often, for example, a loop buddy is actually executed, or how often certain methods are called in the end. And if these counters hit certain thresholds, then the machine stops executing and tries to do more analysis on this specific part of the machine that was measured to be quite relevant for the execution. In these cases, the runtime then does jobs that we classically would consider to be static analysis, or even other methods that are considered to be runtime analysis. But these are all done at runtime in such kind of systems. But there are, well, although these two phases are not so strictly separated anymore, we still call these different optimizations either static or runtime optimizations, depending on whether they can be principally achieved at compile time, where we don't know about user data, or whether they strictly relate on user data being already there. Okay, so much about the general concept of the compiler. In the end, what you should take away from that is that you get yourself the disadvantage of runtime costs if you do this translation, which might pay off when you execute the program several times or for long runs. Okay, so let's talk about how you could, in general, organize your piece of software that gets as an input the program code and puts out code. So we will concentrate on the classical statical approach to program translation and analysis, which you've seen in the second part, where we separate between runtime and compile time. So our task is to get a high-level language specified code, program code, and generate some kind of target code out of that. So for that, you clearly need two different phases. In the first part, you are going to tear apart the things that are specified in your input source code files, and try to get to grasp the meaning, the semantics of what the user has specified in this program code. And with that, you generate a lot of helper structures and a kind of good representation of what the user has specified in a way that you can process it quite efficiently. So that's the internal representation. And from this internal representation, we will do a synthesis of the code that is necessary for the target architecture. So in this part, we'll talk about how, from high-level constructs, you can come up with machine instructions, which are essentially then the code that we are gonna produce here. Of course, there's a lot of compilers out there which are not intended for translation of algorithms to bare metal or something, but for completely other purposes, from translating one language into the other, for converting from one input format to another output format. But the general approach, the classical approach, would be the one that compiles source code programs into machine code executables. Okay. So, to start with that, we should focus on one of the parts, which is, in our case, the analysis. Let's start with the analysis components of our compiler. And again, we identify different special phases in our analysis part of the software. We start still with the input, the program code, and the first thing that the compiler analysis phase will do is start to get a basic meaning of what the user has written. And as we don't have anything at all from the start, we just start with getting the basic units that make up the program. And this is the part where we partition the code in these the things that we call tokens, which are these units of meaning. We call this phase the lexicographic analysis, and it is done with a component that we call the scanner. So the scanner takes the program code and partitions it, and the small pieces that remain are the so-called tokens, and the output of such a scanner is a stream of these tokens. So the scanner chops the input in tokens. That's the general message. The next idea is, well, with these tokens, this is still quite it's quite nice to know about that there are numbers in my source code, that there are keywords in my source code, but I want to know more about the whole thing in order to grasp what the programmer meant. So what we need now is some kind of structure for the whole thing. So the next phase is all about creating a structure from this sequence of tokens. And that is the purpose of the next phase, which is called the parser. It takes the token stream and tries to group the tokens into things that belong together, gives them a title, and that is a kind of sub-part of the input. And when it has done all these things, it groups these now larger units and takes them together when they belong together and slowly creates a hierarchical structure in your program, which is, when the whole thing is done, will end up in the syntax tree of your program. And so what we have actually achieved here is a syntactic analysis. The syntax of a program is its structure, so to say. So, yeah, what we do in this syntactic analysis is detecting the hierarchical structure of the things that we have specified in the input. And it runs on tokens, gives out a tree. So after that, we already have a good idea of the structure of what the user has given us, but there's still more to do. You can have a lot of nonsense which still matches the structure of, for example, C or something, even though the whole thing just doesn't make any sense in order to be executed. You still need more information about what is actually in the input. So what you still need to do is a kind of semantic analysis. And, yeah, what would be, for example, a semantic property of code that you would consider interesting? Or something that is more than just pure structure? Yes, please.
The variables are defined before they are used.
This is, for example, one thing that is cannot be directly seen from the structure from your program. A structural element is something which is very local to your code, which is only kind of spanning a tree or a subtree of your input. And if you want to make sure that only well-defined programs are there, then you need definitions before the use of some names. You always want to know what the name that is actually found within these structural elements of the source code are actually mentioned before somehow and are actually explained before what they actually mean. So that is what the definition is. And in order to get this correct, you need something like a type checking phase. And that is a typical semantical property that we are going to tackle in this semantical semantic analysis. Yeah, how can you, how can you actually represent the semantics within your intermediate representation? Well, that the semantic analysis starts from the structure of your program, which is represented as a tree. And after this run, it has come up with some relations that that connect different spots in these trees with each other. So what you need to do is you need to somehow annotate in the way in which they interact with each other. So what you need to do is you need to have a way of placing this annotation somewhere within this tree, that it be with a hash table or with some other means to attach information to your tree. But that, the type checker then would start with a syntax tree and return an annotated syntax tree, or with a syntax tree that has the slots filled in with the information that you still need. So that is the overview on the whole compiler. Are there any? No, not on the whole compiler. Well, you have seen the analysis part of the whole compiler in this thing. Are there any questions so far? Okay. Ah, there's.
Why do you need to annotate the syntax tree
again? You have the problem that with syntax you can specify things that are valid, like. Yeah, let's do it on the whiteboard here. You can have some C code like this. This is valid C so far. Then you can specify things like X is equal to Y plus Z, and so on. So the code piece that you see here, you would consider as valid or not? Why is it not valid? So you have exactly. So you have this one that which is not valid, which is not defined before. But actually, if you have a look at the grammar that is behind these things, this is ways how to specify the structure of the whole thing. This is a non-structural property that you have. You need to somehow specify that valid C programs need to have this Z somehow mentioned before. And that is something that you cannot express in terms of grammars and trees and all that. You need to have something more. And the concept that is more than just plain trees, because well, you would have something like this is an assignment which has a LHS, which is X, which is on right-hand side, which has an addition, which has an X, which has a Z, like this. These are rules how to create structure. But you cannot express that somehow to the left of this thing there should be something that is a declaration and has a type over here and the Z over here. So that's something you simply cannot express with just pure trees. So, yeah. Okay. Anything else? Good. So let's continue with a look at the very first phase, which is lexical analysis. What does the lexical analysis do?
Sorry.
It gets as an input the program code, and the output is the token stream. So how could we do that? Or what does it actually mean? Well, you have seen, or at least a few from the example before, seen a few of the things that are components of such a language. If you get an expression like this one, XYZ plus 42, you will have to chop the whole thing into bits which make sense to you. So the output should be some kind of units of meaning. And Yeah, this depends, of course, from program language to programming language, but the classical approach to an expression like this would be that most of the languages interpret the whole thing as a unit that represents a named entity. Well, not like this. That doesn't... Yeah, so this one. This XYZ is some kind of unit. These objects are called also identifiers in this case. And we have operators, which count as a unit themselves. And of course, there's numbers. And note that we haven't taken the digits 4 and 2 separately, but we have combined them into a whole unit, which is 42, like this. So these are typical units of meaning of your program, which we call tokens from now on. And you've heard me talking already or explaining already a little bit about the different tokens that we saw there. So these tokens have different ideas behind them. They can be classified according to their meaning, and there's different classes for tokens. So we have, for example, the names, which are also called identifiers in many cases. So these are examples for these types of names. Then there's the constants, like 42 you've already seen, but there's also things what is the English word? The floats, yeah. The floats and doubles. Then there's the constants for character sequences, or strings. Those are all certain types of constants. All of these are also different classes of tokens. Then we have the operators. Well, these are not so difficult. And we have other things that look quite similar to our names, which are reserved terms or keywords. And examples for those are if or int or all of them. Yes, please.
Which category would fall brackets, for example, or semicolons?
How would you classify them? Reserve terms, okay.
Separators?
Well, in fact, it depends a little bit on how the language is organized, of course. And some of them distinguish them, some of them throw them into one group. Separators it depends, of course, on how the grammar is actually specified, because the grammar is then taking the names for these things to define the structure. But in general, I've seen a lot of specifications where for something like a semicolon or bracket, there's actually a whole class that is just a singleton class that only has exactly this this digit or this this character inside. But they might be grouped or might be part of a certain structure afterwards, so they can be sort of renamed afterwards.
How is it handled when you have a technical language like Python where you have white space to organize your blocks of code? So it would be awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Similar to semicolon, but it's white space. So do you handle this
is it an answer?
You can convert white spaces to C-style code and with inserting curly braces at the points. So this would...
Yeah, because you can transform this, but how can this get a note?
You still would need to read them in, wouldn't you? But, was there also...
You can generate some kind of synthetic tokens, for example, an indent token and a dedent token.
So this, I think, is probably how this translation to your CEified structures is probably made. So for other people to repeat what you've already said is that there's ideas for special classes of tokens that treat just these symbols that are in other languages considered as non-contributing, like these white spaces, into special token classes that only survive a certain phase of your compiler up to a certain point where they are still needed. For example, if there's a kind of transformation into an intermediate kind of normalization, or how you might call that, to an intermediate form where they are not so important anymore, and then they are thrown away, probably. There's also source codes where there's actual content hidden in comments, for example, so that you cannot just ignore comments for programs, but you all the same need to process them in order to get certain annotations for parallelization or certain other things. So you might end up with a lot more tokens than you originally thought of for some languages. Also, it depends on the purpose, what you want to do with the whole thing. If you want to do pretty printing, or if you want to implement an editor for something, you might want to keep certain things that you would ordinarily have thrown away for a compiler, like these tabs and spaces and all these things. So, yeah, they might be filtered away, but that is something that we will probably see in a few slides. So, the scanner actually produces these sequences of tokens, of these units, and it also, for the sake of not having to run again, attaches the classification to these tokens already. So you not only get the stream with the hacked input, but you also get the classification for the input things. Okay. So that is now the slide about the topic that concerned us beforehand. This is talking about these for some purposes as irrelevant classified tokens, like the ones for spacing or the comment tokens. These might be dropped for certain uses. For certain, you need to keep them. For example, there's languages that highly depend on the amount of spaces you need. For example, your line starting with exactly five spaces and then with an at or something like that, in order to create. For example, there's make files that rely on the number of spaces that you have in front. So you might still need them, but for other purposes, they might be just irrelevant, so you can drop them. And a lot of these compilers that are using different phases employ a phase that is called the sieve, which is acting as a kind of wrapper around the scanner that can be configured in order to either keep the elements like spacing and comments, or to throw them away. So that is the purpose of this sieve. Yeah, we've talked about the pragmas. These are certain instructions that can be just thrown away for certain appliances. For certain, you need to keep them. And there's also a lot of pre-processing already happening in either the scanner or the sieve part. For example, when you happen to meet things like these, you might, for efficiency reasons, not want to keep the whole string within your representation, but you might want to keep them in a certain index and then only use the numerical constant that still has to be mapped to the original value. And that is something that can be done by the sieve. Also, this, if you consider an identifier or something which is might be arbitrarily long, and programmers tend to use quite long names in certain languages, then you can just keep them in a central location and only do with symbolical constants that denote this special constant. So these are all techniques that can be already implemented at the level of the scanner. Yeah, so the thing that you might need at that point is then a program that runs on a very large string, which is your input program, and then generates a stream or a sequence of tokens. And I'm sure that given enough time and enough motivation, we could probably all implement such a system from scratch, but this tends to be a very tedious thing and also quite error-prone, and you have to think for a lot of corner cases, and at most times you don't want to be bothered with this kind of implementation work. So the general idea for things that are bothersome and repetitive and things that you don't like to do yourself is, why can't I have a program that does the whole thing for me? And that is the idea that is behind this thing that we want to talk about right now. What we want to do is, we don't want to write our scanners ourselves, because that's something that's really boring, but instead we want to generate about only the key ideas of our specification of how token classes actually look like, and then run a program that generates the appropriate scanner for us, so that we can compile that instead of our own thing. That might also be the way to do more correct scanners than the ones that we do ourselves, and also speed up our implementation time a lot. So what we would like to have is a way to generate from some kind of specification the whole scanner component of our compiler. So how can we do that? We need to have a way to specify token classes and then generate something that classifies input according to our specifications. Any ideas of how I would like to do so? What would you do? A lot of if statements and spaghetti code. No, of course not. What would be a suitable specification of classes? Really? No one else? Well, you will probably have to have a look at the examples here. So you have to kind of differentiate between things that look like these, or like these, or operators, or these kind of things. Yes?
Yeah, you could use some specifies the classes, give them the name and the regular expression or something like this to check if a part of the string is part of this.
So as an experienced programmer, you would try to come up with regular expressions for your token classes. Well, that is something that is probably the right way for these kinds of classes, because they are simply syntactical features. You only need to specify how certain characters can follow each other, and that is in most cases done quite well with regular expressions. So we will use regular expressions as our specification mechanism, and as we have learned already in the past, regular expressions have a nice property that if you have a collection of them, you can quite easily generate or find an automaton that is actually accepting the same input than your regular expression would generate as output, as an input, and end up with an accepting state. And automata are things that machines do like quite a lot, because automata can be implemented quite efficiently on common computers. So this would be a quite nice thing to use. So we decide on having regular expressions as our input, as our specification. And then what we want to come up with is a generator that translates these regular expressions into machine-suitable format, which is a finite automaton. And this automaton we will then execute on the input, and each time we will end up in a accepting state. We will yield. Now is a point for finishing the current token and start a new one. So that would be the idea for a kind of automated way to come up with our token sequences from the input. Of course, there will be a little bit more than just finite automata, because we're dealing with several classes for tokens, and we need to find a way to get always the longest match in these things, but we will come to that. So in general, what we seek is regular expressions and finite automata. So we will have a look at the basics of regular expressions and automata at first to get the common starting ground, and then talk about what we can do in order to use that as a generator. So, regular expressions. Back to fourth semester. So, what are regular expressions about? Regular expressions are things that talk about sequences that are composed from characters of an alphabet. So what we have is a finite set of characters, which we call the alphabet. This is for practical purposes. This is something like ASCII or Unicode or something. So these are sets of finite sets of characters. And these we will try to use for specifications of tokens. And the sets of things that you can build up from these character sequences are regular sets, and these can be specified with our regular expressions. So what is a regular expression itself? So there's a quite famous guy, Stephen Kleene. He always get to name a certain operator if you're very famous. So that's the case for this one. Yeah, so regular expressions. What is a regular expressions? Regular expressions are made up from different parts. So there's what we have already talked about is our alphabet. So, this is not the alphabet. So this is the alphabet. So for all characters that can be taken from our alphabet, each of them might occur as a small part of such a regular expression. What we might also find within regular expressions are that we want to note that we don't want to mention any character at that place. This would be the epsilon, which is kind of the empty sequence later on. And we have to take this one from our set of alphabet symbols. So this epsilon is some kind of new symbol, might be something that is realized with an escaped character or something later on. And these basic components of our regular expressions are then connected with several operators. And these operators are actually the clean star. These are the pipe and the dot. And all the things that you can create with just mentioning these components then are regular expressions. Well, so far so good. Examples for that you can find here. So these are typical strings that can be used as expressions. You've probably seen these expressions before. In order to stress what these different things actually are, we use different colors on the slides. The blue for the characters that are taken directly from the alphabet, and the operators or meta symbols we'll print in pink. And in order not to have to use these parentheses, we made for convenience also define a kind of precedence of certain operators. So the star binds more than the dot, and this binds more than the pipe. And also, we might also just omit the dot and just write the remaining two parts of the expression just one after the other. So far for, one further thing. These are common operators that you find in practical regular expressions, but these are just kind of syntactic sugar for operators that you already have in your definition above, so we won't concentrate too much on them. Yeah, so far we are able to write regular expressions, but still there's open, what do they actually mean? And the meaning of a regular expression is something that needs to be defined. And the way to define a semantics for these expression is via mapping them to the set of character sequences that are the meaning for this special regular expression. So what does that mean in an example? So let's have a look at the table here. Here you see specifications of regular languages in terms of regular expressions. This part. So you can see that if you just write your alphabet characters one after each other, you will have exactly the same sequence of characters as the semantics of your expression. So there's nothing fancy about that. You can, with one expression, you can mean several sequences of characters, as demonstrated here, where you have the pipe. A pipe B will actually mean either the sequence A alone or the sequence B. And you might also have sets of character sequences which are infinite by writing a finite regular expression, like the one that you see here. A, B star A, which is just meaning all the sequences which start with an A and end with an A and have only B's in the middle. So these are this is the semantics for regular expressions by example. Of course, this is not exhaustive, so we should come up with a kind of definition for the semantics of these regular expressions, and you can find the function that actually gives the semantics for each expression as these kind of double brackets. So these semantic brackets. And the semantic brackets for the epsilon is actually the empty string. I think I've called it already like this in the past, so this is the empty string. Then the semantics for alphabet symbols is just, well, the string that has exactly the alphabet symbol inside, so no surprise here. Then we have the clean star on an irregular expression, and here we recursively call the semantics function on the right-hand side also, which ends up with all the character sequences that are denoted by the sub expression, and they are related to each other with this clean star, but this time interpreted on sets of expressions. What that means, we'll get on the next slide, I think. For the pipe here, and the two expressions E1 and E2, left and right of it, we will interpret this pipe as just the union of the sets that are denoted by regular expression E1 and E2. And for the dot, we will have as meaning the concatenation of the words from the set for E1 and the words from the set of E2. And you see me already carefully expressing myself, because these operators are now defined or meant to be on sets. So what does that mean? For example, for the concatenation on sets of strings of alphabet symbols, well, if there's a word that is a part of the set to the left-hand side, and a word W2 that is part of the set for the right-hand side, the resulting set will contain all the words that that are in the left-hand side concatenated with the words from the right-hand side. So that's kind of a cross-product that you have from all the members of L1 and the members of L2. Yeah. So there's still remaining the clean star on a set of words. What does that actually mean? Well, what that means is that you take arbitrary words from the set on which you apply this clean star operator and arrange them one after each other. So you concatenate an arbitrary number of elements from the original set to each other. So that's the clean star on sets of words. Okay, so with the help of these double bracket function symbols, we have the semantics for our regular expressions, and we can go on with our lecture. Yeah, you might see slides after today. Next slide in particular, next time in particular, you will see slides that contain regular expressions in a slightly different form, namely in this kind of annotated ranked trees. And this is just expression trees that you should probably have seen already in the past somewhere. So what that means is that for each operator, you will get its sub-expressions on which the operator is working by following the edges. So the star is meant to be applied to the expression that is below, which is a variation expression. This variation is meant to be either a product or the empty set, and the product itself is meant to be between A and B. So that's how to read this kind of trees. Yeah. So in summing up, the inner nodes are operator applications, and the leaves are particular symbols from the alphabet or the empty string. Okay. So, yes, please?
Question for the star thing. K has to be finite, or isn't it?
K is just a numerical value, so there's no repetition there. So there's, but you mean bounded some way?
Yeah. So not infinite, so that there's no infinite large word in our star. So.
Okay. K is some kind of non-infinite value. Yeah, but that still needs to a countable infinite. Yeah, but okay. Yeah. So, any other question? Okay. So, examples for regular expressions in the context of compiler constructions. Yeah, these are taken from definitions for token classes for Java. So we have, in these scanner generators, you often have the possibility to somehow create macros, which means this is a kind of named regular expression, which you can then use in other regular expressions to create even larger regular expressions. So that's what's done here. We define names for other regular expressions. And in practical systems, we might see cases where you don't actually have to enumerate all the units that you make such a variation, for example, from, but you have abbreviations and syntactic sugar involved, like in this case. Here we have a regular expression that should mean one letter with a special range. This is designated by the use of these brackets here. So this means that one of the values mentioned inside is valid for this regular sub-expression. You can have, for example, A, B, D, G, and this would be the same as writing A, B, D, G, for example. So these brackets are a kind of syntactic sugar here. And yeah, you can even more abbreviate what you want to say by using this dash here that can specify ranges. So in this case, the regular sub-expression is about the range from small a to z and large a to z, underscore, and there's also the dollar sign within. And these are all the symbols that this expression may talk about. In general, they want to be addressed as letters throughout this thing. That's what is meant with this LE in this specification. So these might be components that you need in order to create other things, for example, the identifiers. Within identifiers, we will have a letter as the very first symbol, and then we can continue with arbitrary many things, which are either another letter or something that is abbreviated with a DI, which stands for digit. That is very implementation dependent on the scanner generator, so that was actually a good question. That's something that has to be defined, of course. But in this case, it is here, the A has a certain character code and the Z has a certain character code, and all the characters with codes in between A and Z are actually selected with this range operator. And in this case, it's I think it was taken from Unicode, so you'll find all the Unicode letters with codes between A and Z in there.
This theoretically because the between all the Unicode characters tend to
work. Yeah.
And one other question. The backslash in the letter is an escape sign?
This one?
Yes,
yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that is I don't remember the exact product that was used for the specification, but in this one, the dollar sign was actually something that would mean something in the regular expression definition. So we had to.
Normally, the dollar sign indicates the start of a line, so you have to escape it in most regular expression elements.
You see that I'm not working so much anymore on scanner specifications, so that I actually don't remember. But now that you say it, yeah, there's also the curry thing for the other end. So, yeah, this separates. Okay. Yeah. Then there's what's still missing is the digits, and the digits is just another range of characters. That was number 5, I guess. From 0 to 9, these are the digits. Okay, So that's how you would create your token class specifications. You can use several steps in there. You can name your sub-expressions and build larger expressions from them. Don't have to repeat yourself too often. Yeah, there's also beasts like this one. You might want to help me with decoding the whole thing. Of course, the float already indicates something that we have already seen and just seems to be larger than the plain integer. So any idea what the parts mean? Time for parsing. So I assume you start from the very beginning here.
Yes.
So there's a lot of digits, arbitrary number, or even no digit, exactly. And then.
A dot can appear.
Yeah, I see two dots here.
Yes.
And
there can appear a dot there. There also can appear another digit and two dots there.
So the general idea in the beginning is that there's a variation. You can either have right hand side or left hand side. That's why you need to have two of the dots. And now altogether, if you consider this part, that's what you said. There is a number of digits involved, and there's at least one digit somewhere. That's why you have this variation operator here and not just a simple star. This thing must be either right or left of a dot. But you could have, for example, only dot 9, and this would still be a valid float from this definition.
Yes, and after that, there can appear several digits also after the dot.
This one? So
for the exponential.
Oh, just let me don't let me be disturbed from my this one. that's conceptually still part of the number part, and then we have this part. And that's where the expression. So we have some kind of,
it's a scientific notation, you know.
Yeah, and then you might have another few digits, something, and you can have a minus or a plus there. Yeah, so that's what might be there. And the whole thing doesn't need to be there at all, so we might as well delete it once again. Okay, so that is what the whole expression actually means. Yeah, and you see there's already a lot of the complexity of parsing inputs is already going into these regular expressions, but still it's only just one simple unit of meaning that you generate with these token classes. And nevertheless, that's quite a large step, because all the complexity that you take out of the next phase is quite welcome for the whole system, because that's quite a tedious task to do with the next phase, if you want to do these kinds of constructions in the next part. So that's a quite nice thing already provided with the scanner. Also, the constants that you detect with these measurements can already at that point be caught and translated into something more machine suitable. You don't need to keep the whole string in order to talk about a float constant. You can instead convert it into a float representation of the same thing and continue on and have a much easier life from then on. So that's what most cases is done on the scanner level already. Okay, so yeah, that's just for you at home. Let's talk about the next thing in our chain. So we have regular expressions for specifying the token classes. Now we want to talk about the things that we're gonna use for implementing entities that can detect such such members of these classes in the input. And that's what we're gonna use the finite automata for. So let's have a look at what finite automata are all about. So yeah, what we're talking about now is, well, at least for purposes of showing, we will talk about these graphs, which are graphical representation of what an automaton is. And yeah, for example, we have this one. You see different components there. There are these little dots, which are called the which are nodes of this graph that are actually states of the automaton. Then there's these arrows here, which are called edges and have a label, and these are the transitions of the automaton. And these transitions will transform an input student an input state into an output state. I hope it doesn't transform any students. An input state into an output state in case it consumes an A from the input. There's also a few specially highlighted states. For example, the first one on the left, this one, this has a well, an arrow going into the state that does not have any source. This is a kind of notation that we use to mark the start states for our automata, and you see also a state that has a circle around it, which is this one, and this is our way to mark the end states. What you also see is transitions that are labeled with an epsilon, and yeah, these are transitions then that can be taken at no cost. There's no input consumed from these from going these transitions. So if you start from the state over here, you can simply go over there without modifying any input, and can start parsing with. Oh well, yeah, it doesn't make a difference here, but yeah. So that's what finite automata are on the graphical side. Yeah, that's for you at home. And yeah, the formal definition for finite automata, which is without any graphics and just with mathematical symbols, you can find here. These are the people that were kind of the set as the parents for finite automata, which is Michael Rabin and Dana Scott. And yeah, let's start right with finite automata. Non-deterministic finite automaton is something that has several components, each of which you can see here. And in detail, what are these components? You have Q, the set of states. For finite automata, you have, of course, a finite set of states. You also have an input of some sorts. And this input is made up from a finite set of alphabet symbols. And this is called the alphabet, and this is this sigma. Then next, you have these special special highlights that I've shown you already, the states that were had a marker. And there are two kinds of states that were marked. There's the set of start states, which we call the initial states. That's why they are mentioned in the set I. And, of course, there's the final states, which are also a subset of the general state set, and they are in the F set for final states. So, yes, please?
Can there be more than one start state?
We can check the definition for that. Let's move away the markers. Start states here is just a subset of general states, so there's no evidence against several start states so far. Yes, there can be. But that becomes more important in the next definition. So, and also there's the set of transitions, which is considered to be a relation from two states and an input symbol or epsilon. Okay. So, and as you have noticed already, there are important parts about the whole thing, like, for example, whether there are several start states or only one start state, and all that has to do with a certain thing in our definition, namely there's this term non-deterministic. And there are several ways of evaluating these automata right now, which might be end up in a conflict, so to say, but we will see that later on. First of all, let's have a sub-definition of the whole thing. Is signing up? Or? No, okay. Just think. Okay. Yeah, so there are special automata, which are also non-deterministic automata, but they have a special restriction, namely they have only singleton sets for initial states, so that's where your constraint comes in. And also the set of translations, which is was considered to be a relation on the general non-deterministic automata, now turns into a function, which means that there can't be more than one relation between a fixed set of a fixed pair of states anymore. This turns the whole the whole automaton into something deterministic, which is quite a nice thing to execute and interpret afterwards, but we'll see. Because we now need to talk about semantics of these structures. Yes, please.
One question: we just defined non-deterministic automatons, but in this diagram, for example, we do have epsilon transitions.
Yes.
Is this covered because we had not precisely specified what the set of transitions are in this definition? Is this contained?
You mean whether the epsilon transitions are... Actually, you got me at that point. While reading, I was thinking about the same thing. And I think it's that's something that is not clearly pointed out there, because I didn't specify what the finite set... What the set of transitions is actually about and how they relate to something like epsilon and the input alphabet. But clearly, if you have things like these epsilon transitions, they also introduce some kind of non-determinism between edges that are labeled and edges that actually carry this epsilon. So you're right to sign up for that. I should have... included some way to make the epsilon part of the non-finite automata and exclude the epsilon afterwards in the finite part. So, yeah, the deterministic finite automata would be considered to be the ones without epsilon transitions. Okay. Still confuse anyone? Okay. Good. So let's come to semantics of the whole thing. And semantics for automata has to do with computations of these automata, and computations are considered to be sort of paths within the graph belonging to the automaton. And especially the semantics is considered to be the concatenation of all the alphabet symbols that we encounter along a path in this graph that ends in the final states. It starts in the initial states. So accepting computations are the ones that are actually interesting for semantics, and the alphabet symbols which we collect when going from an initial state to a finite state will be contributing to the accepted word, and the set of all the accepted words along the accepting computations is actually semantics for our automaton. So, for example, a valid accepting computation goes from the initial state to the one final state that we have here, and the one that we have drawn here is passing an A and a B, so this will be the accepted word for this computation. So is there any other words that are accepted from this automaton? Yes, please. Maybe. So this is actually the same as, yeah, or including this one. Yes, please. We can do so arbitrarily often, but as long as we only pass epsilon as labels, this will not actually make the sequence any longer. So you can the only interesting computations are actually the ones that end at some point, and so you could circle around. That won't give you any further meaning. Yes, please.
Again, a question to infinite words. As you said before, with those sets, they tail, the number of times you have the thing you start in there has to be limited or has to be bound some way. That's what you said before together. So now the question here. Be bound again with the automaton, because I think you can just sail around infinity and accept a word that has just A, B, A, B, A, B to the end of time. I don't know.
Yeah, well, for the automata here, we only really consider finite things, but we won't fix a kind of length beforehand. So the only thing that we won't accept is the actual infinite sequence. There's other automata for that, which is the Spüchi automata, but yeah, that's...
But we don't really have an upper bound.
No. Yeah, it has to end at some. That's the only... Yeah, so bounded is actually the wrong word for that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So far, okay. Then there's also the formal definition for the whole thing. This is something that probably needs explaining, at least from experiences. People tend to need explanations here. So the semantics for our automaton is the language of words that we will, the language of the automaton that we will consider. And the semantics is actually determined once again via sets of character sequences, as we see here. And in our case, where do we take the words from that contribute to the semantics of our automaton? Well, these are the words that are that occur in a relation, in a very special relation, which is the delta star, and this is the closure of the ordinary small step transition relation of our automaton. This D star is conceptually just the iteration, the path through the automaton. And how the delta star is actually constructed is something that you see here with the transitive closure, and it consists of small step transitions from our delta, and connected transitions. The star that were created through other concatenations of transition things, where the end of our, well, I now destroyed the end state of our small step transition is the start state of the longer path that we have here from P1 to Q. And the smallest things within this definition are the actual node transitions that stay in one place. And with that, you can kind of piecewise extend these small step transitions into transitions between arbitrary states as long as there's directed connections between them. And all these transitions that you can go from one state to another are then captured by this transitive closure, T star. And this is actually the definition that we use down there. So when there are all the valid paths that start at an initial state and end in a finite state are the ones that are contributing to the semantics of our automaton, meaning that the accepted words from these transitions are the ones that we take into our set of words that we accept. Okay, so that's the semantics of finite automata. Yeah, so this is just a small sneak preview into what we're going to do next time. Because is it on this exercise? I think it's not on the actual, but it will be on the next slide probably. So I will just uncover the next slide. Next task will be to come up with a way to convert the regular expressions that we have from their regular expression representation into automaton representation. In the past, especially in the basics of theoretical computer science, you will have seen something like this, which is called the Thompson's algorithm, which is a kind of graphical way to perform this this conversion between regular expressions and automata. The basic idea is that for each type of regular expression, you define a sub-automaton that has clear connection points to the left and to the right, clear start points and end points that you can interconnect with each other in order to compose a graphical representation of the automaton with each other in order to create an automaton that accepts the same input language as the regular expression, which has the same semantics as the regular expression. This is a nice thing. However, it is a little bit exhaustive with the number of states and transitions that it does. So we will next time talk about a more optimized algorithm to generate non-deterministic automata from that. For now, I will stop with this one. I think you will work on that in the tutorial session a little bit more in detail. And apart from that, I wish you a nice week and hope to see you all again next time. And yeah, goodbye.